Let me tell you a little bit about Kristine's background. She did her PhD in physics at the Max Planck Institute for Quantum Optics in Munich. She went on to do postdocs at the Institute for Photonic Sciences in Barcelona and the Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information in Innsbruck. And then she was a university assistant at the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Innsbruck before she came and joined the faculty at IQC just a couple of years ago now, 2017. So Kristine has worked on quantum information processing, especially using light matter interactions. She's also worked on quantum error correction in the context of quantum sensing. And she's been interested in quantum simulations, in particular quantum simulations relevant for high energy physics, and that's what she's going to talk about today.
Hey. Yeah, thank you very much for the very kind introduction, and hello to everybody. Before I get started, let me advertise a postdoc position in case you know somebody who might be interested in working on the topics that I'm going to present to you now. So for joining this young and highly motivated team that you see here. So what we're doing, we're a theory group. So we're a quantum optics theory group at IQC. And basically our common theme or our mission is to find protocols where we can use quantum systems to attain a quantum advantage. And also not only on the blackboard or on the whiteboard or on a piece of paper, but hopefully also in practice. So this means that we are working very closely with experimental teams, as you will see in my talk. We have two research tracks, one on quantum networks and one of quantum simulations. So quantum networks, we worry about entanglement distributions, like new design concepts, like for instance, for 2D quantum networks and how to make it robust. And everything is with the quest to faithfully transfer quantum states and with the vision to work towards a quantum internet. And we have a specific interest also in self-stabilizing quantum systems where we use dissipation in order to get very robust quantum information processing. And yeah, details can be found, for instance, in this publication on autonomous quantum error correction where quantum systems correct themselves. So here's a quest, is to keep a qubit alive, and the vision, as I said, to have ideally one day to work towards self-correcting quantum technology. And having all having said all this, this is not what I'm going to talk about today. Because today I want to talk to you about our track on quantum simulations. And our quantum simulations have a very special focus. We worry about quantum simulations for problems from high energy physics. So these are the questions that are driving this whole effort. So why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe? So why are we here? And what happens inside neutron stars? Or what happened in the very early universe? Or what happens in heavy ion collisions and particle accelerators? So big open questions that all have something in common. Basically, these questions like A, you need the gauge theories or new tools for gauge theories to answer those questions. And also, all of them are really fundamentally hard because they're hampered by the sign problem. So this is breaking this down a bit more concretely. So first problem class is like really dynamical problems. So here I'm talking about the real-time evolution. So here we have a sign problem or topological terms, like questions like why is there more matter than antimatter? Like how can we understand this large degree of CP violations in nature? Like for instance, by studying models with topological terms where you have a complex action problem or high baryon densities. So where for all of these problems, Markov-Chern Monte Carlo has a problem. And so this quest to find sign problem-free methods, so there are several paths. So here I'm highlighting two of them, quantum simulations, which is what I will be talking about, but also numerical methods based on tensor network states. So for this, two remarks. So we have a collaborator, Carl Janssen, who is like in the audience right now and visiting Parameter until the end of May. But there's, of course, pioneering work by Ignacio Sirac, Frank Verstraete, Marie Carmen, Simone Montangero, dot, dot, dot. And you have, of course, your very own tensor network initiative with a guy at whom I'm not looking at now, but who actually developed many of the things that are used today and who laid the foundations. So all of these things are really like roots towards this big overarching goal of finding approaches to really address one day the sign problem afflicted questions. And in particular, those two routes are really two routes towards the same goal, and both paths are actively explored. And for now, I'm not going to say one more word, any word at all about the tensor networks. From now on, I'm going to talk explicitly and exclusively about the quantum simulation, because that's what we are doing in my group. So, but before I go into any detail at all, let me just step one step back and go back again to like this big picture. The big picture is really about building a bridge, basically. So we have quantum information science on the one side, like really we are in particular thinking about current technology, like the quantum devices and the quantum hardware that we have in the lab right now and in the very near future. And we want to build the bridge towards problems and near-term applications in high-energy physics, right? So, and I, as a disclaimer, so I completely come from the left side, yeah? So my group is completely located on the left side, and we are very interested and motivated in connecting with people from the right side of the bridge. And if you're interested in learning more about this, I would be extremely happy to discuss. And if you want to have good review articles, as an introduction, so I can recommend those three very good reviews. And before I dive into this, there's also a disclaimer in order. So this is supposed to be a timeline, yeah? So because so far I was talking about what really motivates us. But this is in the very far future. This is basically the ultimate long-term vision to learn new physics and really shed light onto questions that we really cannot address today. Yeah, in particular, big future goal to simulate quantum chromodynamics one day and answer questions there. But however, for now, and for everybody who does their PhD now and for the next couple of years, and certainly for this talk, we are very much on this side, on the timeline, so here is now, where we're really aiming at just developing a new type of quantum simulator. Right, and so we are completely busy with developing the tools, the underlying concepts. Yeah, it's really method development. Yeah, so basically quantum physics and quantum simulations. This is a very successful field to use it for quantum simulations. For instance, it's very active for quantum chemistry, and there are lots of very fruitful ideas. Condensed matter physics is almost an industry now, and one is very close to learn really new physics here. And here there's a question. Like when I was preparing the talk first, there was a question mark, but then I changed it into an exclamation mark. Yeah, so that is basically the goal, and that is what we believe that we can do, making a quantum simulator, but specifically for high energy physics, and specifically a quantum simulator which will be able to correctly describe gauge theories, lattice gauge theories. And by no means are we going to compete with Markov chain Monte Carlo or with classical people right now, because we are going to restrict ourselves to toy models, or maybe I should better say benchmarking models, and also to small system sizes, because our goal for now is not outperforming the methods that exist today, but rather developing this new machinery, which then later on will also, of course, not replace, but complement existing methods. So I said our goal is to develop a new type of quantum simulator. So why is it different, or how does it differ from the quantum simulators that are developed everywhere else? Well, in order to correctly describe a gauge theory, the dynamics should better be gauge invariant, right? All the states in the dynamics. So this poses certain difficulties. So as it turns out, it poses a whole plethora of difficulties. But a particular interesting one is that I need not only to implement a quantum many-body Hamiltonian, which is really an outstanding challenge in itself, but on top of that, there are everything should be gauge invariant, so I need to implement the Gauss law. So in case of quantum electrodynamics, which will dominate the talk in a bit, in a couple of slides, it would be just this very well-known form, which means that after I'm done with simulating and implementing a complicated quantum many-body Hamiltonian, which describes the theory of my interest, I need to implement all these constraints. Yeah? So in this sense, what I want to have is a constraint simulator, which is kind of different from if I have a chemistry problem, no? So in chemistry problem, I wouldn't have this large list of local constraints that I have to fulfill here. Or this is a bit a pictorial point of view or an artist's view of what I just said. So this is the whole Hilbert space of the system you introduced, but your gauge invariant subspace is fairly small, and you must convince your system to please stay in the gauge invariant subspace, so the physical subspace. So, and yeah, how do we do this? So we have several approaches to this, and today I will talk mainly about two different ones. This is just conceptually, pick your favorite controllable quantum system. Superconducting architectures, trapped ions, Rydberg atoms, what you like. And then you can run them in two different modes. It's like changing the software on them. You can run them as a trotter simulator or a variational simulator, and I will explain what I mean exactly by that. Basically, it's two types of modes, and which modes you should choose depends on the physics question you have. Yeah? So for instance, if you're interested in a dynamical question, real-time dynamics, you would go for the trotter simulator. And most of my talk will be about this. So we had a work in 2016 on this, in which we looked at quantum electrodynamics in one spatial dimension. And so more recently, we did something on exactly the same model, but answering an equilibrium question. Yeah, so here we probed the parity breaking phase transition, as you will see in a bit. There has been quite some improvement in the system size. So in 2016, as you will see, it has been done with 4 qubits, and this part of physics has been done with 20 qubits. Right. So, both pieces of work concentrate completely on the Schwinger model, so quantum electrodynamics in one dimension, as benchmarking model, so therefore I'm going to introduce it here, and also it captures many of the features of the new projects that we work on in my group right now, which also go beyond quantum electrodynamics. So here, just to introduce my notation, here we have electromagnetic fields, the vector potential and the electric field, which commute canonically. For the matter field, we have just a regular two-component Dirac-Spinor with particles and antiparticles. And the Hamiltonian is exactly as you would expect. So here it's in the continuum with a kinetic term. So here the coupling strength is called G, so would be the elementary charge in this case. M is the fermion mass, and E is just the electric field. Well, this is just in one spatial dimension, so here our gamma matrix is just a Pauli matrix. First thing to do is to put it on a lattice, so here you see discretized space. So if we go from the continuum to the lattice, using the lattice spacing A, we get this identity. So here on the lattice sides carry the matter sides, and the links the gauge fields. So if it's on the lattice, I call the electric fields L. And so here are Wilson's Stargardt fermions, where the two-component spinor is split, that the odd lattice sides have the upper part and the even lattice sides have the lower part. So with this, we have the Hamiltonian on the discrete lattice. And for completeness, let's also have a look at the Gauss law. So as I said before, if we go mentally back to three spatial dimensions and the continuum, it has this well-known form. And in terms of our Stargardt fermions, the charge density in this case, so it's the difference, it's the divergence in one dimension of the electric field, and the charge density takes this form with the factors minus one. Okay, so what do we do with it? This is our model, but what do we look at? Well, first thing, we want to put it on a trapped ion quantum computer. So this was work when I was in my past life, basically, when I was still living in Innsbruck and working at IKOKI, very close to an experimental group, working a world-leading experimental group, having a fantastic trapped ion system. First thing is to really map this model on a trapped ion quantum computer, and I will talk about how this can be done. And then what we explored was just a very paradigmatic effect, just the instability of the vacuum, so particle-antiparticle pair creation. And because we could, we also studied entanglement in this process. And now I'm going to leave out like a lot of details, and I'll be happy to talk about everything later on, but you can also find all the details in these two publications. So if you're looking more for the experimental details, you can look them up in this paper, and then there's a longer follow-up article which has a lot also on the noise analysis and also more details on the theory. Okay, so with this, let me just mention that the protocol that I'm going to show you now, it has been really custom tailored to this particular platform, so there's a mapping between the method that we chose and the platform, which was trapped ion in this case, which allowed for a very efficient implementation, which really made it possible to do this with really current quantum technology. But if you have another favorite platform, so this is not the one-fits-all approach. Yeah, if you want to do it on a different platform, you should use probably a different protocol. So this is the whole protocol or the whole approach in a nutshell. So basically, the scheme maps the Schwinger Hamiltonian to a pure spin model with long-range interactions by integrating out the gauge fields, as you will see. And well, then you get a very exotic spin model, which just results from the elimination of the gauge fields, and which is something that you do not find naturally in a trapped ion computer. But we have a whole toolbox for engineering interactions, and applying this toolbox, one can very efficiently realize this in a digital fashion, as you will see. And the nice thing about approaching the topic at hand in this way is that you have exact gauge invariants by construction at all energy scales, and as you will see, also very efficient use of resources. Right. So this is just to reiterate what I just said, that similarly as you could do numerically, integrating out the gauge field leads to long-range interactions. And basically, I'm not going to walk you through the details, but what you get in essence here is a spin model, which looks like this. So what you see, this is an effective model. I kind of jumped over a lot of steps in between because our original model was, of course, a fermionic model, but it was one-dimensional with quasi-local interactions. So the first thing that you can do is a Jordan-Wigner transformation. And so in one dimension with just quasi-local interactions, so nothing bad happens. Yeah. So you can just go from fermions to spins. This is why I can cast everything in the form of Pauli matrices here. The second thing is, I had gauge fields theta and E, but here, it's one dimension, so I can just go ahead and eliminate my vector potentials, which is why I have only electric fields, and the electric fields can be eliminated by means of the gauge constraints, so which is also a special feature of 1D, but if you're interested later on, I'll be very happy to explain how this can be extended also to higher dimensions. Okay, basically what you get is a pure spin model by means of this mapping. So what you can see, the spin model, the first thing that is kind of nice is that it features only two body terms. Yeah, so two body terms is what you have in trapped ions, and also local terms, so it's two body at most. What is not so nice is that you have complicated long-range interactions. So I'm specifically referring to this term. Instead of giving you, do I have the coupling matrix? No. apparently I was only planning to give you the coupling matrix, but here's a pictorial illustration for six particles. So in this pictorial representation, you see that the first two spins interact with a coupling strength, which is 4 in arbitrary units, and the third and second interact with a coupling strength, which is only 3 of these units, so weaker, and then only 2 and only 1. Yeah, so it's a very asymmetric and strange coupling matrix. Basically, every ion is interacting with its left neighbor with constant strength. Yeah, for instance, the fourth one interacts with coupling strength 2 with all its left neighbors, but with a linear decreasing coupling strength with all the right particles. So everything that I want to tell you of this is that this is nothing that your ion trap would do naturally. Yeah, I mean, this is what we want, but it's not what we have. Okay, so then what do we do about it? Well, in order to implement it on a system like this, let us first look at the resources that we have. Yeah? So what we actually have, and this is already diving into the experiment. So the experiment, as I said, was done in the group led by Rainer Blatt in Innsbruck and Esteban Martinez. He was like the leading PhD student on this. So this is a blade trap here with four ions trapped. So we have our qubit defined here in the SMT substates. And what you have in principle in the system is you have all the tools that you wish to have for universal quantum simulation. So in principle, you can do everything you want because you have high fidelity local operations and you have an entangling gate. So in this case, you have the so-called Milne-Sørensen interaction, which is of XX type and which is an all-to-all connectivity, which is good. Yeah, because as I said earlier, the strategy of encoding everything in a pure spin model led to long-range interactions, which is of course not surprising. No, we integrate out the gauge field, and the price that we pay for getting rid of the gauge field is that we get long-range interactions instead. Yeah, so like in real life, in the Coulomb case. Okay, and as you see, the Milne-Sørensen interaction that you have, that's the main working horse here in these trapped ions, you have long-range interactions already, which shows you that the method is a good mapping for this, is a good fit for this platform. Yeah. Because you don't have the need to explicitly simulate your gauge fields. You don't have to put a quantum system in order to represent your gauge field. Instead, you pay the price of long-range interactions, but long-range interaction is something that you have, of course, in trapped ions.
Kristin? You? So are you saying that by construction, all the states that you could have in this spin chain now are already...
gauge invariant.
The encoding of the gauge invariant degrees of freedom of the original system.
Yeah, so basically what I'm saying is in the beginning, if I have the original model, I have all the matter fields and I have all the gauge fields. And in principle, like many approaches, like also many proposals before, what they did is like for each gauge field, you put a quantum system which is now representing this and like you're simulating it explicitly. Yeah. But in 1D, you don't have to do that. I mean, you can just integrate them out. And then you get a model which has only the matter fields. And the gauge fields, exactly as you said, they appear in the form of the interaction. Yeah. And as an added benefit, everything is gauge invariant because you use the Gauss constraint in order to eliminate them. And it's very efficient because if you would do like this approach of putting some quantum systems for the matter, putting other quantum systems for the gauge, then you introduce like a big Hilbert space, and you're not using it, no, because you're using only the small gauge invariant subspace, and on top of introducing this Hilbert space, which you're not using at all, you got yourself the task of taking care that you're not using it. So people do it like imposing energy constraints or whatever, but here, you stay within the subspace like automatically, no, because it's in the constraints, so it's in the dependence of the interactions. Basically, these funny interactions are basically the Gauss law in disguise. Yeah. Okay, of course, I have still the minor task of convincing my ions to please interact this way, that it reflects the Gauss law. But I have a good starting point, because a good starting point is that local operations are extremely efficient, are fast, are cheap, are precise. Yeah? And I have an entangling gate, which is already like long range. Yeah, it's a good starting point. Okay, and then basically what we're doing here is we do a Trotter decomposition. And the Trotter decomposition is basically I'm implementing not the whole Hamiltonian at once, but I'm implementing parts of the Hamiltonian one at a time, and then I repeat it over and over again. Basically, I make a coarse, so this is the total simulated time, and I cut it into time pieces of duration t, and each of them is again divided into three sections, and each section is responsible for repeating, realizing one part of the Hamiltonian. And then if you do this over and over again and make your time slices small enough, you can show by means of commutation relations that in the coarse grained time picture, this resembles your original Hamiltonian, which has all terms at the same time, which is an approach, it's just digital quantum simulation as pioneered by Zed Lloyd. I should have the reference here. So basically, there's an efficient approach, which is just linear in the number of steps that you need in order to assemble, take the building blocks of the interactions that you have in order to get the interactions that you want in a coarse-grained time picture. And how this then works in an experiment is as follows. So this experiment was actually the first experiment in which like a gauge theory from high energy physics has been realized. So it was a simple model, but it was the first step in which this has been done. So we wanted to monitor pair creation, right? So in order to monitor this, what we did is we monitored the particle number density. You can write it like this. Basically, what this operator does, it just counts how many pairs you have. So charge is a conserved quantity in our Hamiltonian, which means if we start from the bare vacuum, so the bare vacuum being encoded in a state like this, you will only create or annihilate pairs, particles and antiparticles in pairs. Yeah. So this would be a state with particle number density zero. And if we have spin flips, this is basically what will happen in your trapped ions. You switch on the Hamiltonian, as I showed in the last picture, like you switch on the Hamiltonian or a sequence of gates that will give in the time averaged picture the correct Schwinger Hamiltonian and will lead to a lot of spin flips, and you will get configurations like this, which in the staggered fermion picture would correspond to vacuum-vacuum, and these have been flipped. So this in the original model represents an electron-positron pair. So this would be particle number density of 1/2. And this is just the translation table that I used. And this is the result that you expect in the ideal case. So here is time, dimensionless time, so where I multiplied by the constant W, which is a prefactor of this term. So so here's the particle number density, and if we start from the bare vacuum, and by bare vacuum I mean the vacuum for infinite mass, we start with the state, and then we switch on the Hamiltonian by in the experiment, shining a lot of laser pulses, and we get a lot of flips, and we reinterpret them like this, and then you see that the particle number density goes up, reaches maximum, and goes down again. Yeah, so particles are created, but they can also be annihilated, so it goes down again. So, of course, everything is only valid in the time-averaged picture, so if you choose a time-coarse graining, as I did, then you get a discretization error already. I mean, everything is still perfect, only the discretization error is then what you get here. This is actual experimental data from 2016. And after post-selection, and I'll be very happy to explain what this means afterwards, and including a simple error model, which is just defacing. So we believe that we understand the errors in this model pretty well. So I jumped over a couple of subtleties in order to not to spend too much time, but the whole Trotter protocol has been constructed in such a way that there are no gauge invariant errors happening. Yeah, so it's a very robust protocol. So this is exactly what you see in the experiment. You switch on your Hamiltonian, you make a quench, you see how the bare vacuum is unstable and particle-antiparticle pairs are created. So you can do this for different particle masses. Yeah, I see there's a question.
Yeah, sorry, can you back? So the green line, how are we supposed to understand this is the idealized situation? So why is there such large discrepancy above within the expected and the actual measured thing?
Yeah, so for instance, here in the end of the curve or in the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, there is, above omega. Omega, I don't know what the middle, for time, for the right half of the plot, you see that there is huge discrepancy in the data compared to the green line. The beginning looks fine, and then after you reach 0.5, the drop-off is less efficient.
So why this is?
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually we pinpoint, we made an error budget later on to pinpoint what is the main reason for the deviation. And the main reason of the deviation in this case is indeed a technical one, which then later on was removed. So in the new experiment, it's not there anymore. But it's hiding and unhiding errors. Because like the Molmer-Sorensen interaction, it's acting on all, it's an all-to-all connectivity. Like if you shine your global laser, it would make all particles interact. And for our protocols, we need to select subgroups so that, for instance, we only want to have particle 1 and 2 participate in the interaction, but 3 and 4 not, which means in the experiment they have to be hidden. And by hidden, I mean they're transferred into internal electronic states which do not participate in the interaction. And then when you're done, we unhide them so they are brought back to the logical two states. And as it turns out, this hiding and unhiding, you can introduce errors by doing so, and these hiding, unhiding pulses, you need like a lot. Yeah. So this overall gate sequence is 222 gates for this. Yeah. And these hiding, unhiding errors that like they contribute a lot to the error budget here. I mean, this is something which in future experiments will not play such a big role because there will be no hiding and unhiding. There will be methods that allow you directly to make. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know whether something happened to you, but simply shocked by what I said. I'm a bit shocked myself, but in future, there will be experimental ways to just address just a subset of ions and just make them interacting without the need to hide or unhide them later on.
So, Christine, this hiding and unhiding really involves other degrees of freedom?
Yeah. So there, you have a lot. I have backup slides which shows you the whole level scheme. But basically, in the beginning, you have all these levels, and you pick two, which you call 0 and 1. But you have plenty of others, and you just put them into another level at which they are not interacting with the global laser, which makes interaction.
So you don't use a stroboscopic strategy where you just have lots of pulses that annihilate effectively.
I'm not averaging it out. No, I'm not averaging it out. No, this I'm really shelving them away. Yeah. I'm really parking them somewhere else. Yeah. Okay. Right. And so what I wanted to say here, in our Hamiltonian, there's a fermion mass, and you can vary the fermion mass. I'm making this now a bit shorter. But basically, if you have a higher fermion mass, then of course it's energetically more costly to create a pair. And then what you see on this picture, even though it's a bit of a busy slide, is that the rate at which you create pairs is suppressed for higher particle masses, but which is exactly what you expect because it's more costly. But before I finish up this part, let me just walk you briefly through this, which is entanglement creation in the process. Yeah? So everything that I said before is experimentally much more easy to do because it only involves measurements which are local, right? If I want to infer just the particle number density, I can make local measurements to get this information. I could also have mapped out all the electric fields, and we even did this, I just didn't show the picture, but you have the full site-resolved information about the particle densities and the gauge field densities. But since we have a small system size, we can as well also look at the entanglement. Okay, this is something that I might not be able to do for larger system sizes, but for now we can. And so here we look at the creation of entanglement, which happens with pair production. So to this end, we made a full state tomography. And by we, I mean our experimental friends did the state tomography, evaluating the logarithmic negativity if I cut the chain just in half. So here you see I had created a pair, so there's entanglement between the two halves. And here's the logarithmic negativity versus the time. You see it has a very similar shape. No, so as entanglement, as pairs are created, entanglement is created, and we are plotting it for different masses. So here, if the mass is higher, it's less likely to create pairs, less entanglement is created, but also for different costs of the electric fields. And this has an even more pronounced influence. Why? If I create a particle-antiparticle pair, I have to pay a cost. On the one side, I have to pay the cost for creating the particles, so I pay the rest mass, but if I create a pair, it comes also with a string in between, right? There's a flux, there's an electric field between the electron and positron, and this I also have to pay. Yeah? And if they're more farther apart, then I have like two fluxes, three fluxes, I have more fluxes in between. And so this costs more and more. So increasing the J, which is a parameter which is telling me how much one unit of electric flux costs me, it does not only suppress pair creation, but also it suppresses the mobility of the pairs. Yeah? So they are less likely to stretch over the bipartition, and so this has an even more pronounced effect. So this basically already wraps up what I wanted to say about the Trotter simulation. Just as a reminder, this is a strategy if you have a time evolution question. Yeah? And as I mentioned, this is really a real-time dynamics. It's really motivated by the fact that this is something where where Markov chain Monte Carlo is not applicable. And if you look at this particular problem and you look at system sizes of like 50 lattice sites, you would be already quite in trouble if you want to calculate this. Yeah? So if you have a chain of 50 ions, you're going already in the regime where it becomes really difficult with current methods. Okay, so now I go to the right side. So it's really a switch of gears. And so if you want to read up details on this, you can look at the archive. It's going to appear in press very soon. It's on the same model, but it's a very different type of question. And this has been performed also in Innsbruck in the experimental group of Rainer Blatt and the in collaboration with the theory group led by Peter Soller. And I'm not putting picture of all of the authors, but the two main authors who are like really the first authors, both of them contributed equally, Christian Kokail and Christine Meyer. Yeah, we can see that Christian and Christine are very popular names because we had two Christians and two Christines on one paper. Right. So the method was very different here. This is what I call a variational quantum simulation. Basically, it taps into the power of both classical computers, but also quantum devices in a closed feedback loop. So we have a classical computer here, which has an optimization algorithm, but we have a quantum coprocessor, which does all the cost function evaluations for us. And so here's a closed feedback loop where you are suggesting some optimization parameter. You evaluate your cost function here, and you deliver back the measurement results, and then you make the next iteration. Okay, and this is already a very thriving field. Like, people try to look at this method of hybrid quantum classical optimization, and we had actually a very lively week just last week here at Parameter. So Martin Savage was visiting. Carl Janssen is still here. He's also very interested in this. Fiala, who was an Eminuta fellow here, her student Asa, who is even in the audience, like are all interested in applying these type of methods for problems in high energy physics. And here, I mean, of course, making this bridge is very young, and also like using these types of simulation methods is even younger. So there are a couple of papers on this, like also, for instance, some papers by Martin, where people are really trying to make this work. And like we are also interested in using these variational quantum simulations, and we have a very, like we have our own approach to this. But before I go into our take on this type of setting, let me just introduce to you how it is done. So we have a target Hamiltonian, yeah? So the target Hamiltonian lives only on the classical side. Yeah? So the target Hamiltonian is only known to the classical computer. So our quantum processor knows nothing about the target Hamiltonian. But we have a set of resource interactions. Yeah? So we have a set of resource interactions. And here, in our case, we don't even assume a universal set. In our case, we are very strongly motivated by the fact that most quantum platforms, they come with native interactions. Yeah? So this is basically what is native to whatever platform you choose and what your platform is good at. And yeah, typically what you want and what you have is not always the same. So we have our target Hamiltonian, which can be fairly complicated. It might have long-range interactions, which you do not have on all platforms. It might have, for instance, three body terms. Yeah, which is typical for a gauge theory. It would be, it could have four body terms, something that I really don't have on my resource, which might be, for example, just local terms and one type of two-body interaction, for instance. And then I'm creating a variational state. I'm making an ansatz. Yeah, in our case, I mean, you can do plenty of things with these type of hybrid optimizations. What we want to do here is creating ground states of interesting models. Like we pick our favorite gauge theory and we want to know the ground state. Actually, we don't only want to know it, we want to prepare it on our quantum device. And this is a specific ansatz. Yeah? So in the ideal cases, hopefully we'll be close to the ground state. We start from an initial state. This initial state is something that is easy to prepare. And then we apply a sequence of gate operations that is composed only of resource gates, the ones that I have on my platform. And you see the strength with which I apply them is just classical parameters theta, and these are my variational parameters. And it's the job of my classical optimization algorithm to find the best possible set of classical parameters in this closed feedback loop in order to get a good approximation to my ground state. And this is done by optimizing this cost function. So this is the target Hamiltonian again. And of course, for the ground state, this would be minimal. And just as a last remark, so this ansatz can describe a highly entangled state, but it can be a short recipe or short parametrization. Right, and since I already talked for 45 minutes, I go into wrapping up mode now. So just to tell you what has been done in this new experiment, it was again using a trapped ion quantum computer. Slightly different one from the one that I showed earlier. It doesn't have a Mollmann-Sorensen type interaction, but a spin-spin Ising type interaction, which looks like this. Looks like a, as I said, like a Ising model with a transverse field, and single qubit rotations on the Bloch sphere. And basically, this is, in a nutshell, what has been done. So here's your 20-qubit analog quantum simulator, and this is exactly the circuit which realizes this ansatz. So this ansatz, which I was writing as a formula before, is basically shown here. So you have your very simple product input state, which you can easily prepare. Then you prepare, then you apply your Ising type interaction, local interaction. Ising type interaction, local interaction. And you do this in several layers. And this is the circuit which is just reflecting your ansatz. And then you measure in the end what you have prepared, and you can give the specs just a central data repository. And you can evaluate different cost functions with that. And I'm going to cut this a bit short now. But what has been done here is a ground state preparation of the Schwinger model. what I showed you before, we started from the bare vacuum, from the vacuum for infinite mass, but this is really the full vacuum, or I could say the dressed vacuum, which is a highly entangled state. So you see, starting from the bare vacuum, this is the energy, and this is against the iteration of the classical algorithm. So you see how it goes down and converges here at the ground state energy. And this is just a pictorial representation of the particle density that you want to obtain, and you see how in a pictorial representation, like, you get gradually the right state. Basically, your feedback loop finds the state for you, basically. And so once you have the state, you can probe interesting physics with this. And here, what has been probed is Coleman's phase transition, parity breaking phase transition. So in this model, so we fix the coupling. And so you see here, the mass is varied from large negative values to large positive values. And what you find here, if the mass is very large and negative, then it's energetically favorable to completely fill up your system. And if the mass is very positive and very high, then we are back to our bare vacuum. And here in between, you have complicated entangled states. And plotting a suitable order parameter, which I will be happy to explain later on, you can really witness this phase transition. And this is just the half-chain entropy, one-third chain entropy, which shows you that the entanglement grows during the phase transition. There are a lot of things to say about this very interesting experiment, like, for instance, that it was a really problem-adapted variational approach, which was very resource-efficient. Basically, this was not the arbitrary circuit. So this circuit was really respecting the symmetries of your problem. I mean, this is a gauge theory. I mean, it comes with its own symmetries. And the circuit is respecting the symmetries, which made it extremely efficient. So basically, to say, I'm looking for the ground state. Yeah, it's like if I lost my key in a villa, but I know I lost it in the kitchen, then I'm not going to look in the bathroom. No? But I can restrict my, I can basically, by the symmetry protecting circuit, I can make everything really extremely efficient, also in the number of variational parameters. And so this is a problem-adapted approach. And there are new exciting features, like accessing not only ground states, but also excitic states, and also the very important topic of self-validation and verification. And I'm not going to dive into this, only if you ask. I will close up with this slide, saying that there are, of course, related demonstrations. And if you got interested in this, you might want to look also on other efforts, like, for instance, efforts on hybrid quantum classical simulations, for instance, on Rigetti and IBM machines. So there have been efforts to simulate the deuteron, or also on 1D QED. And there are also a lot of efforts ongoing. So this field is now really picking up speed. So this is not published yet, but people are working on this intensively in an analog fashion. So for instance, at IQC, if you want to come over visiting us and visiting Chris Wilson, so he's implementing one-dimensional quantum electrodynamics with superconducting architectures. And in Heidelberg, they're pursuing a very dedicated effort with ultra-cold atoms. There's a ton more to say about this, and I expect many new exciting experiments. But for now, let me point you to next challenges. So these have been only first steps. Yeah? Our whole field is only in kindergarten. No? We are looking at low-dimensional models. So far, everything was in 1D. So it will be very exciting to go to more dimensions. Next step is to go to 2D, also to go to increasingly complex theories. Yeah? So it would be very good and very interesting to include color degrees of freedom. Yeah? This is also something we're looking at, realization of non-abelian theories, and more challenges along the lines of how to verify and validate quantum simulations. So basically, this is in the very beginning. There's lots of really unexplored territory. And I really want to thank all these parties for support. Also, and in particular, Perimeter Institute. So the Emmy Noether Fellowship was just incredibly helpful. And I hope to have a chance to talk to all of you even more about these topics. With this, I thank you very much for your attention.
Questions for Christine?
So in the variational quantum simulation, can you experimentally realize periodic boundary conditions?
Yes. I mean, it has not been done yet.
Now,
okay, so I should correct that. So there's a publication which looks at the Schwinger model. As I introduced it here with periodic boundary conditions, this was also done by Martin Savage, but it was without the magnetic term.
So it would be feasible if you're looking for a ground state to restrict to, say, a zero momentum sector and only look for the purity sector of your Hilbert space for this Schwinger model, for example.
Yeah, in a sense, without the Plaquette term, that's pretty much what he did. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? In, I think it was in the truck simulation, you mentioned the need for post-selection. Is that generic?
Oh,
or
generic.
What exactly?
Yes and no, it's an important, okay, but this is a very interesting topic, no, because quantum simulators, especially as they grow bigger, there will be errors, and so what do you do about it? I mean, in trapped ions, in principle, you could do error correction, but of course, this is, I mean, you have, in principle, on paper, you have all means for error correction, but you don't want to do this, yeah? So what we did instead was error filtering. Yeah. So something that happens in this type of experiment, for instance, you can have bit flips, and bit flips, okay, it's not naturally occurring bit flips because those are very rare, but due to the pulses that we apply, you can have something which will result in the end of the day in a bit flip. And this is a very bad error, right? Because if I flip a single bit and you translate what it means in the original model, it's you have created positron alone. Yeah, I mean, you have completely jumped into a different charge sector. Yeah, you started with charge zero, and then all of a sudden you create a positron all by itself. Yeah, so we certainly don't want to have this, but at the same time, it's something we can very easily check for, right? Because the original Hamiltonian has charge conservation, like charge is always zero, and if you translate it in the encoded picture which I presented here, you have magnetization conservation. Yeah, we start with magnetization zero. And we will always stay, like the whole Hamiltonian, the whole sequence will always be magnetization preserving. You should never go out of the magnetization zero subspace, unless you do something like this, you have an error. And a very easy thing to do is, like, you measure your end result, and before you write it down, or before you plot it, you check what is the magnetization, and if it's not zero, you throw the result away. This is a very simple error filter, which is adapted to the problem. And then, of course, you have to make sure that the success probability is not exponentially small, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense. But in this case, it's just polynomial, and it scales reasonably well. So in this case, and also the fidelity scales reasonably well, because there are, again, errors which you don't see if you have not only a flip, but also a flip and a flop, right, which would again, have magnetization zero. So those things you naturally overlook. But so the error filter scales okay, and it's incredibly helpful. Yeah. So if you look at the density matrix before and after error filtering, you know which one you want.
Can you say something about how far away the experiments are from simulating a theory that cannot be done on a classical computer?
That cannot be done on a classical computer. Yeah, it depends on the problem that you want. Like, for instance, if you look at the Schwinger model, like exactly what I talked about, so if you do exactly the same thing, but with particle numbers 50 and above, then you would be already, like, at the brink where it becomes... But this is for real-time dynamics.
You mean 50 qubits?
Yes. Yeah, so 50 qubits equaling 50 lattice sites. Yeah, but this is for real-time dynamics.
No, I just realized you can work in Minkowski space, right? It's not a problem for you. So you have the full light cone available. Just
is not available for us on the lattice. So in principle, one could think of a lot of physics that has to do with the inner structure of proton and neutron and the analog in your benchmark models. I think this could be a very interesting thing because the light cone is not available for us.
Mm-hmm. So this is why I work with Kai.
You need to work in Minkowski space by just simulating time beforehand.
No.
Okay.
So can you say something about the time scale that you would reach, say, 2 plus 1 with SU2?
Yeah, I hope that both will happen in the next couple of years. Yeah, so this is very close within reach. I mean, either 2 plus 1 or colors.
How many lattice sites could you simulate presently if your Hamiltonian didn't? Like, suppose we're like free fermions. You want to do real-time dynamics, so they're only nearest neighbor gates.
Can you say it again?
Let's suppose you're not doing a gauge theory.
I'm not doing a gauge theory.
So maybe you want to just simulate a free fermion model. How many qubits could you throw at that at the moment?
So you're saying if I just have a...
Like, there's only nearest neighbor couplings in your Hamiltonian.
So I throw away my constraints, or...?
Well, like you're just simulating a theory that had no constraints in the first place. So yeah, there.
Yeah, but then again, it depends whether I can simplify it or what, like,
yeah.
Okay, I think about a Hamiltonian, and if it's like, if the Hamiltonian is just a random matrix, you're thinking?
No, it's like the Ising model. It'll be something like the Ising model.
Okay, so if I have just the Ising model with long-range interactions, or because with long-range interactions?
Literally the Schwinger model, but without the electric field. So like then you'll just get, the Hamiltonian you wrote down there, but without the long-range term.
So right, but with the gauge field integrate, because in principle it has three-body interactions, but you want the gauge field still integrated out, I guess, because Ising I only have if I have a two-body interaction.
Well, maybe we'll talk after. you'll get the Hamiltonian row, the spin Hamiltonian. But you'll just don't have...
Yeah, but which was after integrating out the gauge field?
Well, there will be nothing to integrate out because they weren't there. So there's nothing to integrate out because they're not there. But like you'll just get the same Hamiltonian wrote down, but without the long range term. So you'll get a...
Yeah, after integrating out the gauge field. Yeah.
Sure. It's like xx plus yy plus... I'm just supposing that... Just say for the sake of argument...
But if it's only nearest neighbor, I don't think it's the Ising... Okay, you have the expert actually just to your left. I understood if you have like Ising with long-range interactions, then it seems to be difficult also for matrix product states. But if you have only nearest neighbor, I think it's pretty efficient.
Not for real-time dynamics.
Okay, you're thinking real-time dynamics.
Right.
Okay, actually this I don't know. Yeah, for real-time dynamics this I just don't know. But Stefan could know this. Huh? He almost worked on this. I know, I was thinking about getting the ground state because I was still in the second part of the talk. Yeah, no, but for real-time dynamics, I honestly don't know, yeah.
Because it looked like you had like 15, 20 qubits or so in your variational thing.
Yeah, but which was not in the variational thing, we can currently not address dynamics.
But
in future, maybe, but now it was really about equilibrium, like getting ground state properties.
Well, I thought you exploited the fact that the system had natively had nearest neighbor interactions, didn't you?
No, in neither of the two cases. So like in the first case, we had the Molmer-Sorensen, which has like infinite system size, like which has infinite interaction, like spanning the whole system size. It was a Molmer-Sorensen type, it's all-to-all connectivity. And in the second case, it was an Ising type interaction, which is quasi-local. So it's a decaying, it's one over the separation to the alpha, and alpha can be 1, 2, 3.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I mean the resource Hamiltonian in the second case already can give rise to situations where you cannot address it efficiently, classically, like Chris Monroe and Rainer Blatt both did some work also in the Ising realm. And by Ising, I mean now quasi long range Ising. Yeah.
Any further questions? Okay. Not this thing, Christine again.